Hey, good evening, everyone. I'd like to welcome Rabbi Daniel Feldman to the first of his weekly shiurim given at Beth Aaron. This week's shiur is being sponsored by Richard and Ellen Gertler, commemorating the yahrzeit of his mother, Chana Perel Bas David HaKohen, and his grandmother, Chana Leah Bas Fishel David. Rabbi Feldman.
Good evening. Thank you. Before I begin, just a few words about the general theme of the series, the general goal. What I would like to do, if this is what people are interested in, is a basic survey of some key topics, some key figures that appear in various places throughout Shas. We call Shas figures. Some of the fun, you see the topics that come up a lot, to go through some of the key points that come up in these topics, some of the key questions, some of the key issues, some of the key positions that are taken. Basically kind of a survey of that, if that's something that people find interesting, so I hope you'll let me know if this is the kind of approach that you're interested in, if there's specific topics that you'd like to hear about within this category that I'm very interested in hearing. For now, just I wasn't sure which topic to start with. I thought I would deal with a topic that has some relevance a little bit, very tangentially, to Purim this year, has more relevance to other things that happened this year, has some relevance also to Daf Yomi. I don't know if anybody is holding in Daf Yomi. They started Brachos now, which happens to be in a day to tomorrow's Daf. So there's a Tosfos in tomorrow's Daf, a little bit of treasure hunt. So there's a Tosfos in tomorrow's Daf that's relevant to this topic as well. And also, it's also relevant to the first Daf in Brachos. So a lot of little connections. I thought maybe it might be a good time to talk about it. The issue is basically the relationship of Chazal, of Dinim Darabanan, and Dinim Min HaTorah. And to what extent do the rabbis have the ability to regulate and to effect Dinim that are in the Chumash itself? And this is something that is particularly relevant to this year, because this year many of our Yom Tovim fall out on Shabbat, the Sana, first day of Sukkot, and Purim also, in theory, falls out on Shabbat this year if you're living in Yerushalayim, if you're in a walled city, so the 15th of Adar falls out on Shabbos, and that affects all of those days. All of those days are changed by the fact they fall out on Shabbos, because the shofar is not blown on Shabbos, the lulav is not taken on Shabbos, and the Megillah is not read on Shabbos. And all of these, the Gemara explains, based on the Gezeirah D'Rabbah, this is a concern that's associated with Rabbah, that we're afraid of carrying. We're afraid that in all of these instances, maybe some issue will come up with the shofar, maybe some issue will come up with the lulav, and you're going to want to know what to do, so you're going to come to carry in the street, you're going to come to carry in the shofar. So because of that concern, so Chazal told us, don't blow shofar on Tetzaneh. Don't take the lulav on the first day of Sukkot. Even though, Min HaTorah, we're obligated. Torah says to blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And doesn't say, but only if it doesn't fall out on Shabbos. Following the din of the Torah, one would have to blow a shofar on Rosh Hashanah no matter what day it falls out. Following the din of the Torah, one would have to take the lulav on the first day of Sukkot, no matter what day of the week it is. And yet, the rabbis somehow have the ability to tell us, we know, we're aware, we're pretty experienced in the Torah ourselves, we know that the Torah tells you to blow a shofar, nonetheless, we're telling you not to. That's a very striking concept, and the Gemara explains, the Gemara actually doesn't explain it in this context, the Gemara explains it elsewhere, and it's generally assumed that this is a reflection of this principle, but the Gemara says in the Yevamos, and that's the Testament days, and that's Sadi, it could be goes on for a little while. The Gemara says, Yesh Koach, there is the ability, there is the power, Bidei Chachamim, La'akor Dover Min HaTorah, that the rabbis do have the ability, they do have the authority to uproot something in the Torah, the Sheval Taisa. Sheval Taisa we're going to translate for now as passively. As we'll see, it's not the only way to read it, but just for now we'll assume that's what it means, that the rabbis have the ability to uproot the matter in the Torah as long as it's something passive. In other words, presumably, to use a broad example, the rabbis are never going to tell you to eat the trace. They're not going to tell you to be Mechal Shabbos. But something like don't blow shofar, don't take lulav, something that's basically passive, in its essence, apparently the rabbis have the ability to do that. What kind of justification do they need is a question. Some of the examples that we'll talk about seem to involve issues of personal loss, issues that have to do with personal problems. Some assume that it's only applicable when there's an issur at stake, when they're afraid of some violation of a prohibition in the Torah. So then the rabbis put into place their ruling. Like the examples involving shofar and the examples involving lechatana. So there, they were afraid of carrying. They were afraid of a violation of the din of the Torah. So protect the Torah, they put in this rule. Another example, which the Gemara links more clearly. The Talmud says that one is required to attach tzitzis to a garment, even if that would result in shatness. If you have a linen garment and you're going to tie wool tzitzis to it, that's going to create shatness. Nonetheless, that's the din of the Torah, you're supposed to do it that way. However, says the Gemara, the rabbi said not to. And they were afraid of any number of things. They were afraid, as Gemara looked, four things they were afraid of. They were afraid that one would come to wear this garment at night, when there's no obligation of tzitzis, and then there would be no mitzvah of tzitzis, and there would still be a prohibition of sadness. They were afraid that perhaps the tzitzis wouldn't be kosher, and then you would have sadness again without the mitzvah of tzitzis. For various reasons, again, here you have a situation where the Torah said, here's a mitzvah, and the rabbi said, you know what, hold off. So clearly we find examples where they're motivated by a worry about prohibitions, they're worried about you carrying a Shabbos, they're worried about you wearing shatnez, so that you for sure find. But you also, as yourself, you find some other things that don't fit into that category, and that there's some debate about. The Sagittarius in the early 1600s, in his commentary in the Gemara, it's known as the Turei Eben, so he suggests that they only implemented these concepts when they were trying to protect prohibitions. And as far as some of the other examples we'll find, those of other commentaries explain that's not necessarily against this principle, because the Torah Evan was talking about the sweeping across the board debaters, that no one should blow shofar on Shabbos, that no one should carry a lulav on Shabbos. That was only put into place when a prohibition was at stake. But there are more localized instances where even without a prohibition you find this effect in place. So basically, just to recap, so we have this idea sometimes that the rabbis put an enactment into place that results in us passing up a mitzvah in the Torah. And I'd like to discuss a little bit how is that possible, what exactly is going on, what are the mechanics of this concept, and some of the related issues. Should we take questions afterwards? Should we take a bit, if it's not a very pressing question, maybe we'll take the questions at the end. Okay. So, this is a topic that was discussed with great beauty. A very attractive piece, a very beautiful piece, in Rabbi Chaim Wasserman's Sfarim, printed in two of his Sfarim, the Kovet Ha'aretz to Maseches Yevamos, and the Kovet Shiurim, the other Maseches that are dealt with in Kovet Shiurim. He has a section there called Kuntres Divrei Sofrim. The Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, he talks about a lot of issues related to rabbinical law, the ability of the rabbis to make gezeiros, and how does that play out, and how does that manifest itself. So he has a number of essays under this heading, Kuntres Divrei Sofrim. So this essay is printed twice, both there and in the Sefer and Yevamos. It's really a very beautiful piece. And I'd like to draw a little bit on what he says in that piece. There's a couple of additions and a couple of changes, but largely draw from his framework to illustrate how this topic comes together. Rabbi Chanan, in discussing this piece, used three basic questions. Three chakiros, three conceptual questions that lay down some of the core issues in this topic. And the first issue is prompted by the language in the Gemara. The Gemara uses very extreme language. The rabbis have the ability, lakor government at Torah. They can uproot something in the Torah. Seems to suggest the rabbis really can cancel out something in the Talmud. Very stark language, lakor. So ask the Bochana and ask the others, is that meant to be literal? Is that what's going on? Are the rabbis really canceling out something that's in the Torah?
Or is that beyond their talent? Does it make sense to say that the rabbis can really rewrite the Chumash? Or should we assume that that's not what's going on? They can't rewrite the Chumash. The Torah is going to say whatever it says. But their authority is such that they're allowed to put into place a din, even if that din will result in your not following exactly what the Torah says. This is something, we'll kind of doesn't go into this, but this is something that could relate to a more fundamental issue as to how do we relate to the power of Chazal in general. What's going on when the rabbis put an enactment in place, when the rabbis say that it's prohibited midrabbanan to eat this food? Right, if you have a chicken cheeseburger, we assume that's an issue of rabbanan, and so we assume that min haTorah there isn't any problem with cooking chicken and milk. That's our din d'rabbanan. So the rabbi created an issue chicken cheeseburger. What's the status of that? So there is an often quoted comment of the Nesivos HaMishpat. Nesivos HaMishpat in his commentary on the Shulchan Aruch about 300 years ago. So he made a comment which many quote and many take in a certain way. It's a very popular view in Achronim that suggests there is a fundamental distinction between a biblical prohibition and a rabbinical prohibition. That when you have a biblical prohibition, so we know the Torah describes penalties for violating biblical prohibition, and the Torah even prescribes penalties for accidental violation of biblical prohibitions. If you do an aveira b'shogeg, so there is still what to fix. There's karbonos to bring. There's still what to get out of your system. That presumably the aveira had an effect on you, even if it wasn't intentional, and there's still something you have to clean up. But suggests in Yeshivas, and he has a proof from the Gemara for this point, that if you do an issa d'rabbanan by accident, so then there's nothing to fix. Then you don't have to do any type of kapara. So why is that? Why should that distinction be? So many suggest that there's a fundamental difference in how mitzvot d'oraisa and mitzvot d'rabbanan work. The mitzvot d'oraisa, there's something inherent in the object. God made the world, and God wrote the Torah, and God said, don't eat chaz. So chaz has something inherent. There's something inside the object spiritually that's harmful. So that means whether it's intentional, whether it's not intentional, there's something there that's not good for you spiritually. But when it comes to the chicken cheeseburger, so the chicken cheeseburger was neutral. There wasn't anything inherent in the object. The rabbis came and said, you're not allowed to eat. Now, we're obligated to listen to the rabbi. Why is that? It's a big question. There's a dispute between the Rambam and the Ramban. But the Rambam ties it to a pasuk in Parshas Shlosim, where the Torah says, if you come, give an issue, you don't know how to deal with it, so you come to the Chacham of that door, and will soften the Hadavar, you're not allowed to deviate from that which they're going to tell you, not to the right, not to the left. You have to listen to them. So the Rambam and the Ramban disagree with the whole story, which is not so much for tonight. But the Rambam says that's the requirement to listen to the rabbis. The Torah tells you you have to listen to what they say. So what does that mean? That means that we have to follow the rules. But it doesn't make anything inherent about the chicken cheeseburger. The chicken cheeseburger was neutral before, so it's neutral now. The rabbis don't have any authority over the cheeseburger. They don't have the ability to change the spiritual composition of the food. They have authority over us, so they can tell us not to eat it. So, apparently, what's the position of the Nesivos HaMishpat? We're not supposed to rebel against the rabbinic command. So if we're going to intentionally eat a chicken cheeseburger, that's a rebellion, that's a merit, that's wrong to do. But if we didn't rebel because we didn't know it was an accident, so there's no rebellion, and since there's nothing inherent in the object, apparently there isn't anything to atone for. It's only needed atonement if it was intentional, if it was an act of rebellion. But if it's not an act of rebellion, you don't know. And there isn't anything inherent in the object, that's not a problem. That's the view that many, many Achronim take. The Chasam Sofer is a tshuva like that, and the Mekat Rebbe is a tshuva like that. Many, many Achronim took this view, that there is this distinction between biblical Yisurim and rabbinical Yisurim. A biblical Yisurim may have something inherent in the object, whether you know about it or not. And rabbinical Yisurim, by definition, can't have anything going on in the object. It's all about your responsibility. happens to be there with those who disagreed. Perhaps most prominently among them is Joseph Engel, the great Talmudist about 200 years ago. Joseph Engel wrote that there are various midrashim that tell us in the context of Moshe Rabbeinu and in later contexts as well, that God agrees to what the rabbis do. The rabbis put a din into place, and God agrees, God endorses it. So yes, before the rabbis came along, the chicken cheeseburger was neutral. But once the rabbis came and said it was prohibited, so then God restructured it. God made it into something inherently wrong. So these are two views that exist in general as to how to look at the influence of rabbinic law on the world, whether or not they recreate the situation on the ground. Or do we say they can't really do that, they can only tell us how to relate to the situation that's there. And that's really very relevant to this question. How does it relate to mitzvahs? When the Torah tells us, blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah, whether it's Shabbos or whether it's any other day of the week, and the rabbis say don't, so what happened then? Do we assume, like the first view would sound like we're going to see this, that whole story, that the rabbis can't rewrite the Torah? That's not within their power. They have authority over us. The Torah tells us we're not allowed to rebel against the rabbis. We're not allowed to deviate from what they tell us. So therefore, the Torah says whatever it says. There's a mitzvah of blow shofar on Shabbos, Rosh Hashanah. And the rabbis told us don't. The rabbis have the ability to say, stay away. Or do we take a view more similar to what the Joseph Engel said? That maybe they really have the ability to rewrite things, that God agrees afterwards to whatever they put into place. And just like the chicken cheeseburger could become inherently bad, so too, God will now agree that there is no more mitzvah to blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah for Hashanah is Shabbos. And it's no longer a religiously significant act. So this is a question that Achronim dealt with. It's a question that Rabbi Chanan asked, and it's a question that others started to ask before him and after him. What's the story? If I take a lulav the first day of Rosh Hashanah, I took it, If the rest of we all agree, it'll be nothing. If I take a lulav the first day of Sukkot, this year, when it fell out on Shabbos, so did I perform a mitzvah because I wasn't supposed to? Or no, that mitzvah no longer exists. The rabbis redefined it. There's no longer an obligation to take a lulav the first day of Sukkot when it falls out on Shabbos. Now, small nafkamina would be, let's say somebody did that, he took a lulav the first day of Sukkot this year, and now the second day he wants to make a shechianu. So is this the first time he's fulfilling the mitzvah? Or do we say, no, the day before he fulfilled the mitzvah, he wasn't supposed to. So it was an issue in the Rabbanim, the rabbis told him not to. But once he did it, it's a mitzvah. Or do we say, no, now there is no longer such a mitzvah. The Torah has been changed, so to speak, Kadosh Baruch Hu agrees. There's no longer any religious value in blowing shofar on Rosh Hashanah after Shabbos and taking a lulav on Sukkot for Shabbos. This is a question that actually comes up in a number of other instances. One of the instances in which it comes up, I mentioned it was in Daf Yomi 2 weeks ago, at the very beginning of Brachos. So if you got that far, people will still start at the beginning. So you probably got to the first Mishnah. So in the first Mishnah, so you see that there is a machlokas when Kriyasma can be performed at night, Kriyasma at night. And there are three opinions of the Mishnah. Two of them are Rabbi Gamliel and Chachamim. Rabbi Gamliel says it can be performed all night. The mitzvah of Kriyas Shema can be performed all night. And Chachamim say only until Chatzos, only until midnight. And it comes out from the Mishnah there and from the Gemara as well, that really Chachamim agree conceptually with Rabbi Gamliel that Kriyas Shema can be read all night. But they thought that it's worth putting a gezeira into place, they have to worry that people will be too lackadaisical about it, and therefore they should make sure to read Kriyas Shema before Chatzos. So Rabbeinu Yonah, in the back of the Gemara, Rabbeinu Yonah has a striking statement which Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva about, and the Shagat Aryeh had a long discussion disagreeing with. The Rabbeinu Yonah says that Chachamim were so emphatic about their decree, they believed so strongly in this gezeira, that they made the rule not only that you should say Kriya Shema before midnight, before Halachic midnight, but that if you don't, it's over. It's too late. That even though the Torah allows you to say Kriya Shema all night, and apparently after midnight you would have an obligation, as the Magamliel tells the sons in the Mishnah, you have an obligation to recite Kriya Shema, The Chum said, no, we took it away. We got rid of the obligation. We had the ability to erase this part of the Torah. It's no longer true that Kriya Shema can be fulfilled all night. It's a very controversial statement, partially because it doesn't really match the other types of models that we have. Here there isn't any Azera that's at risk, and we're dealing internally with the same mitzvah. To limit the same mitzvah like that is a little bit of an unusual type of situation. So Rav Moshe Feinstein took on this with Yona, and earlier decided to die, he did. It's very controversial with Ben Yona. It's not that controversial because the Ben Yona happens to write that he thinks the Ben Gamliel is right anyway. And he thinks the mitzvah applies all night. He's just saying that according to Chachamim, that's what Chachamim did. But that's one reflection of this possibility that maybe they do have the ability to do that. And this is a question that comes up in a lot of other areas as well, because it can be rephrased as, what happens when the rabbis redefine a mitzvah in HaTorah, or when they add more details to a mitzvah in a Torah? Does that change the essential mitzvah? Two of the most prominent examples of this are Kiddush and Birkas HaMazon. Both of these are assumed to be mitzvahs in HaTorah. Torah says, Zachar es ha-mesav ha-kadsho, it's a mitzvah of Kiddush, that's just recite something Friday night. And the Gemara says in Tzachim, Zachor Zachreyu Ahayayim, you should remember it in the presence of wine. Whether or not that aspect, the wine aspect, is part of the Din Darei, says the Big Machlokes. This is the beginning of Nazir, and the Gimel Amid Beis, and Dara Meralis is a Machlokes between Rashi and Tosus. Not real Rashi, the fake Rashi, the Mepharis. There's a Machlokes between the Mepharis and Tosus, and the Rambam, and the Shiva Parashba, and the Tosfos and Sofim, a lot of different opinions as to whether or not there is an obligation in the HaTorah to use wine for Kiddush. Many assume that really there isn't an obligation in the HaTorah. The obligation in the HaTorah is to say Kiddush. Wine is a Din D'Rabban. So that prompts the question then. If Min HaTorah Kiddush only means saying something, and the rabbis came along and said, well, now it means having wine, so what if I don't have wine? What if I just say something without wine? Do I say, well, at least I did with the Torah, so at least I fulfilled the mitzvah in our Torah. I didn't do it perfectly, I didn't get to the rabbinic detail, but at least I fulfilled my responsibility in our Torah. Or do we say, no, the rabbis came and they changed the rules. Now, Kiddush means wine and saying something. And if you don't have wine, you don't have anything. Makes a big difference, because when you go to shul and you daven Friday night, so the Magen Avraham says you fulfill Kiddush with davening, even though you don't have wine. That's a question, a lot of ramifications of that assumption, which is a different topic now for tonight, but that all goes to this question, do the rabbis have the ability to redefine this mitzvah? Another example would be benching. Benching is also assumed to be a mitzvah in the Torah, the Achalta, the Sadasa, the Rakhta, but Rakhta, we assume that that's three paragraphs. The fourth paragraph, the fourth bracha of benching, was added to the Rabbanan. And again, Tosfos asked the question, so what if I bench with three paragraphs? So am I at least fulfilling a mitzvah in our Torah? Or do we say, no, it's not even anything anymore, the rabbis redefined it. This, many assume this is a machlokis between Tosfos and Aran, the beginning of Masechet Sukkah. And that's Gimel of Masechet Sukkah. So there is a comment there, there's machlokes between Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai, certain details about how to observe the Mishnah Sukkah. And in the context of these details, which are details of the Rabbanan, is that Gezeirah thinks we're afraid of, and the expression there appears, in Kain HaYisa Noeg, if you acted this way and without following these rules in the Rabbanan, Lo Kiyamta Mitzvah Sukkah Mirmasa, you have not fulfilled Mitzvah Sukkah your entire life. So that Gemara seems to imply that not fulfilling a biblical mitzvah the way the rabbis told you to do it knocks you out completely. Nothing, you haven't fulfilled the mitzvah of Sukkah. And that's the way Tosfos seems to read it. Tosfos over there in that Gimel and Aleph and Sukkah seems to say that yes, the rabbis came and said that's the way it is now, and if you don't follow these rules, there's no mitzvah of Sukkah, it's nothing. While the Ran takes a different view. And the Ran says, no, it's not true. The mitzvah that I told you still did. It just means that Lokiyamta Mitzvah Sukkah perfectly. You didn't totally fulfill the mitzvah Sukkah the way the rabbis wanted you to do it. But they can't ignore the fact that the basic biblical mitzvah that you at least fulfill. This line is the same as what she talks about, which is consistent with another comment that he has on a much more famous Mishnah. More famous Mishnah because it's part of the Haggadah that's coming up. So we have a Mishnah that we recite as part of the Haggadah that calls for almost close to Bar Mitzvah. Doesn't do every second day Pesach Matzah Lamar. So it's not Yotzei his obligation. So says the Ran, and that's Mishnah and Tzachim. Same comment he makes here. That the Mishnah doesn't really mean to be as harsh as it sounds. So what you ask for your day chavasa, you didn't fulfill your biblical obligations because you didn't say these things. No, that's not true. The rabbis want you to say these things, so you're not fulfilling it perfectly if you don't do it. But the mitzvah, the Torah, you still fulfill. So it's the same position the Ran expresses there, and the Ran expresses in the Sukkah, that if the rabbis added detail for the mitzvah still fulfilled without it, it's just more ideal in this format. While Tosfos seems to take the position that no, the rabbis can redefine what's going on. So basically, this is the first question. So the first issue that Rabbi Chanan lays out, and we just went into a couple more details about it, but basically the first issue that he lays out is this one. What do we mean when we say La Kor Davar Min HaTorah, to uproot something Min HaTorah? What's going on? Do we assume the mitzvah is canceled? It's gone, it doesn't exist anymore, there is no mitzvah to blow shofar unless it's done after Shabbos? Or do we say no? There's no such ability. The rabbis can't rewrite the Torah. They can't change the world. Rather, they have authority on you. The Torah says, well, Sosa, you're not allowed to deviate from what they say. So therefore, you shouldn't blow shofar unless it's done. But the mitzvah still exists. That's question number one. The second question that the Bohanim put out there, and it's something a little bit different than he does, but this is basically the gist, is what do we mean when we say Sheva Al Tase? That's the other phrase that's thrown into here. Yes, Kalach, Lachlo, Government, I tell you, B'Sheva Al Tase. They can do what we translated before as passively. But what does that really mean? Because the truth is, we could understand that in two ways. On the one hand, that could refer to behavior. That any time I have to do something active that would be against the Torah, the rabbis wouldn't tell me to do that. To actively get up and rebel against the Torah, that's not going to happen. They can tell me to sit at home. Sit at home and wait something out, not go to school to hear Sofer, not blow Sofer. That they can tell us to do. But to actively get up and do something wrong, such a blatant rebellion against the Torah, that the Chazal are never going to be able to tell us to do. Come on. That's one view, which seems to be assuming that anything active is always more of an issue than anything passive. That a sin of commission is always worse than a sin of omission. If you're going to actively do something, that's always more of an offense than to just leave something out. So that would be too much. The line is drawn between active and passive. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that no, it's not about your behavior. It's an issue of categorization. Some mitzvot in the Torah are mitzvot asay, and some are mitzvot lo asay. Some things are categorized as obligations, and some things are prohibitions. And we generally tend to assume that prohibitions are more severe. The Torah lists punishments for violating prohibitions, and with two notable exceptions, there are no punishments listed for leaving out mitzvahs, for leaving out obligations. There's a general assumption that violating something that's categorized as a prohibition is more of a severe issue than not fulfilling an obligation. Now, for 85% of the cases, these two categories will overlap. Most things will fall into the same both categories. So if I say, as I said before, the rabbis aren't going to tell you to eat trace, that would fall into both definitions. Eating trace is an action. I'm going to do something. And it's an issur in the Torah. Don't eat non-kosher food. It's an issur in the Torah. It's a lot. So for most cases, it doesn't matter which definition we choose. But occasionally, it does matter. Now, for example, to not bury someone immediately. The Torah phrases that as a prohibition. Lo salim. Don't don't leave him. It's a prohibition, it's a law. But one violates this passively. If one just stays home and goes to sleep, so one could violate this prohibition. So what's that called? Is that called a shave out house or not? What if I take a shavua that I'm going to eat a pretzel today? So if I don't eat a pretzel, that puts me in violation of a prohibition. And a prohibition of lo yachel tovaro, it's a lot in the toes. But I did it passively, I just stayed home and didn't eat it. So there are cases in which it's going to make a difference. And this is something that Achronim discussed, not only in this case, but there are at least two other sugyas in the Talmud, there are at least two other places where this comes up. One place in which it comes up is Kavod HaBriyos, human dignity. The Gemara says, roughly coming up in Daf Yomi another 2-3 days, Gemara and Brachos Daf Tes, and other places. The Gemara says that Kavod HaBriyos is a very powerful principle in Torah, so much so that it can be docha certain things, it can push away certain principles, even a din min ha-Torah b'shev al tasha, even a din in the Torah, if it only means violating it passively, so that could still happen. Now what does passive mean there? So the same question is asked, the same question that Lachanan asks here. So the Stifler has a discussion about this, and the other Sfarim have a discussion about this. This basic question, when we talk about passive, are we talking about our behavior? Or are we talking about los essays versus essays? The third area in which this comes up is that the din, the Gemara says in Ksubis, that you're not supposed to spend more than a fifth of your money on shtakas. That even though we recommend giving a minimum of 10%, but there's an upper limit of 20%. And the Ramah, Hokus Lubo, the Ramah says this is true not only by Tzedakah, but it's true by mitzvahs as well. You're not supposed to spend more than a fifth of your money on mitzvahs. So then the Ramah gives a distinction, which the Gaon didn't agree to, a number of others didn't agree to, but the Ramah was more famous on this point, so it's assumed that this is a distinction, that this is only true by mitzvah sasei. For a positive mitzvah, you're not obligated to spend more than a fifth of your money. But for low sasei, then you have to spend everything. Then you have to give kol hon beis. And there's only going to disagree, just a little bit of a discussion, but this distinction apparently exists there as well. So in all three areas of this halacha, the question of the ability of the rabbis to cancel principles in the Torah, the question of Kavod HaBriyos, and the question of spending money. So in each one, Achronim discussed this question, well, how do we define our terms here? Are we talking about passive versus active? Or are we talking about, Afshays versus Loshashays? And just to give some examples, the Rashba has a couple of comments which all reflect one view on this. So one, just to mention very quickly, the Gemara at the beginning of Shubas, Nafdimel Amadei, Bala Maral, the Gemara has a very sad situation there. Situation where you have a chassan and kala about to go to the chuppah, and Rahman was fine, one of them loses a parent. So they have an obligation of Shiva. So the Gemara gives a whole scenario there where you can push off Shiva and have the Sheva Brachos first, and delay Shiva until afterwards. So some Rishonim ask, well, how does this work? If we assume that Shiva and Sheva Brachos are both rabbinical creations, we tend to assume. So then fine, hey Amru, behem Amru, they've made the rule. So they can tell you it's okay in this case to push off Sheva for Sheva Brachos. But there are Rishonim who believe that the first day of Avelis is an obligation in HaTorah. The first day of Avelis is a Dimin HaTorah. So, after the Ran, after Rashba, how did the rabbis push off an obligation in HaTorah to allow you to have Sheva Brachos first? So the Ran and the Rashba both give the same answer, but there's a crucial difference in the way they phrase it. They both say, well, no problem, we know the rabbis do that sometimes. That yesh koach lakor davar min haTorah b'shev al tasha. Even if it's a din min haTorah, it's a shiva that first day, the rabbis can cancel it, the rabbis can say don't. However, says the Ran, but remember the end of the sentence, b'shev al tasha, they can only do it passively. So therefore, the first day of Sheva Brachos, he says, they shouldn't be parties. They don't have to say shiva the first day, but since it's Avelis, they can't do anything active against the Avelis. They shouldn't have parties, they can not do the responsibilities of Shiva, but they don't do parties either because that would be active. And the Rashba leaves that out. The Rashba doesn't make any such qualification. And as the Bachanan and others explain, that seems to be the issue here. That the Ran understands the point as one of behavior. The Ran says you have to behave passively in these cases. Because the rabbis can't tell you to actively party during Shiva, because that would be an active violation of the Din Torah. They can only tell you to stay at home and not sit Shiva. But they can't let you do anything else. The Rashbah probably holds. Said, no, Arvelus is a concept, is a positive mitzvah. It has details that manifest themselves as what not to do, but there's one big assay of Arvelus. So what do the rabbis do? They cancel it. They got rid of the assay, which they can do. They can do an assay, and therefore the whole thing falls apart. There's no longer any obligations of Shiva. You find the Rashbah reflecting this opinion in a few other places. For example, the Rashbah has a comment in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, in the middle of Masechet Rosh Hashanah, in which he says that if the rabbis were to tell you to do a mitzvah twice, that would not be bal tosef. You know, there's an issue to add on to mitzvahs for Torah, but telling you to do a mitzvah twice would not be bal tosef. How do I know, says the Rashbah? Because we know they have the ability to tell you not to do mitzvahs. Yesh koach lachid avim ha-Torah b'shev ha-Torah. So it must be, that's not bal tosef. Right, it must be that telling you not to do a mitzvah is not bal tosef. So telling you to do one twice is not bal tosef. So Achronim asked, wait a minute, Rashbah, why don't you say that just like the Oker, whatever mitzvah they bring Oker, the Oker bal tosef also. It is bal tosef, but they got rid of it. Why don't we just say it like that? So apparently the Rashbah would hold, they can't cancel bal tosef, because bal tosef is a prohibition. Even though it would be just as hashish to have you not do something. But since technically it's categorized as a prohibition, therefore they can't do it. So the Rashbah is again consistent in looking at categorization rather than behavior. And a third example, I use my personal experience of learning with the Chavisa many years ago, we're learning Masechet Gittin. And the Gemara in Masechet Gittin has a discussion about Prozbul and about Shmita. And there the Gemara says that the reason Prozbul works nowadays is because Shmita is only the Rabbanan. That Shmita Min HaTorah doesn't apply nowadays, so Shmita is the Rabbanan. And the Gemara asks on that, well, how could that be? How could you have Shmita the Rabbanan? But here you have a situation where I owe you money, and I'll see HaTorah, I'd have to pay you. And I'm going to now not pay you what I owe you. And says Rashi, I'm violating Rosh Chodesh by not paying you. I'm violating the prohibition against stealing. And yet the rabbis apparently said it's okay for me to do that. The Gemara says, yeah, it's okay to shave all prices, passes. So apparently what's going on, it's one of the two answers in the Gemara, So apparently the Gemara says that since it's passive, it's okay for them to tell you to violate Rosh Chodesh, the way Rashi understands it. But according to the Rashba, it's not going to work, because Rosh Chodesh is a prohibition. So for me to stay at home is fine, but I'll be violating a law. How could they tell me to do that? So I asked Nachav Rus at the time, what would the Rashba say about this? And we came up with a brilliant suggestion. You should open the Rashba and look. So we opened the Rashba and did, and we saw he doesn't understand the Gemara the same way Rashi does. He has a whole different explanation. He redefines the subject. And he said it's not like Rashi, because it won't be consistent with the Rashba's position. The Rashba believes, apparently, that Chazal cannot cancel out a prohibition, even if they would do it passively. And the same Rashba, that says that they could oker Arvelus, and they can't be oker Baltigra, and they can't oker Bosigra, it's all the same position throughout, that he looks at it categorically, not in terms of behavior. So this is the second question Rabbi Yochanan asks. And the second question is, how do we look at these things when we say that it has to be Sheva al Taisa, we say it has to be passive. How are we defining passive? Does it mean this is how I behave? I behave passively, I'm not doing something active? Or is it a reference to the category we're talking about ashev rather than low subject? The third question the Bukhanan asked, and this one's much shorter than the first two, so relax. The third question that the Bukhanan asks is, why is it that we insert this clause? Why don't we just say, look, there's an opinion in the Gemara like this, that once the rabbis have the ability to be okay with government, so they can do whatever they think is right. If that ability exists, Why is it limited this way? What's the nature of this limitation say about Titus? Is it some arbitrary limitation? What does it mean? Why is there this limitation? And he assumes that there are two basic theories to explain it. His question is, which one of the theories is correct? On the one hand, you could say that the theory is that it's just a question of severity. That kumziase is a more earth-shattering deviation than Seve Altaisa. That would be a much greater uprooting. And apparently their ability is limited. They have the power to go up against the Torah to a certain point. But not that much they could actually go so far as to uproot a Rosasa, or to uproot something to kumziase. So they have powers. It's not that much power. It's a question. It's a quantitative distinction. They have the powers to uproot Seve Altaisa, but not kumziase. That's one theory. The other theory he has, and he just wants to know which one is right, assuming it's one of these two. The other theory is the basic principle of dealing with conflict. You're here, stuck between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, you have the Torah saying, blow the shofar on Shabbos. On the other hand, you have the rabbi saying, don't blow the shofar on Shabbos. So it's basically, you know, you're a little kid, your mother's saying do this, and your father's saying do that, and they're opposite things. So what are you going to do? You cannot make them both happy. There's no mutually acceptable position here. Anything I'm going to do, I'm going to get one parent upset. If I'm going to blow the shofar, so then I'm not listening to the rabbi. If I'm not going to blow the shofar, then I'm not listening to the Torah. I'm basically stuck. How do you win? The answer is you can't win. So how do you get hurt less? How do you lose less? Well, if you stay out of it, if you sit quietly, we always say, shave your tights or others, that if you sit passively, that's better. That at least you're not flying in anyone's face. Okay, so I'm not really making the Torah happy, because the Torah said, don't blow sulfur, blow sulfur, and I'm not doing it. But I can't make them both happy, so at least it's safer to not blatantly do something wrong. So maybe, suggests the Bukhanan, it's just an issue of cutting your losses when you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. That you are forced to choose one. So you'll choose the one that's less offensive. You'll choose the option that's less of an active disobeying, disobedience. That is the third question. Now the point is, the beauty of this piece is that really all three questions come together. All three questions are really the same question. So if one assumes that Chazal really were okay government of Torah. Chazal really removed something out of the Torah. Question one. So then, presumably, the answer to question three, we'll go a little bit out of order, the answer to question three is that they can only go so far, they can only uproot up to such a degree, and something so severe, the kumziase, they can't go that far. So then, how do we define Shevi'al-Taisa versus Kumziase? We define it as a function of severity. And Losaseis and Aseis apparently are indicators of severity. We assume that Losaseis are more severe than Aseis. So the rabbis are really uprooting something from the Torah. They can only go so far. And that's defined by whether something is an Asei or a Losas. Alternatively, if you want to say that the issue is that they have not really uprooted something in the Torah. They don't have that authority, it's like the Nisivas on this book. They can't redefine the reality in the world. They only have authority over you. So the authority over you doesn't change the Torah. So basically, it's the scenario we just described. The Torah is telling you to blow sulfur, and the rabbis are saying, don't blow sulfur. And the Torah tells you to listen to the rabbis. So what do I do? I'm stuck. I have the Torah saying, listen to the rabbis and blow sulfur. And those are not both able to be satisfied. So the best I can do is stay out of it. And that's why we say, Seve Altaisa, I should act passively. But if that's the reason, then how do we define Seve Altaisa? We define it by behavior. We don't care whether it's called a Losase or Ase. My whole point is I'm trying to lay low. I'm trying not to do anything that's going to be actively offensive. So therefore, the definition is all based on how I act. And it's not at all affected by whether we call it an essay or a loss, okay? It's affected, like the Rasba, by being behaviorally passive. down in as being behaviorally passive and regardless of how it is defined. That is basically the structure that Bachanan gave us. I think we'll just want to quickly review what we spoke about and try to keep it in place. So the basic issue that we dealt with was the ability of Chazal to affect dinim in the Torah. The fact that we know this seems to happen in the case of blowing shofar and lechasana on Shabbos and taking a lulav on Shabbos and Megillah on Shabbos is related, but that's not a thing to give them in our Torah. And not wearing sitzes for that Shabbos. And some other examples of cases where the rabbis made a gzera, even though it tells us to ignore dinim in the Torah. And the Chazal said, yes, yesh kalach la'achor davar min haTorah b'seiv yalkayis. And we mentioned that there were three basic questions to consider about how this works. On the one hand, what's happening when we're okay davar min haTorah? Is it that the Torah is really being rewritten and this one no longer exists? There's no value to blowing a shofar on Shabbos. There's no value taking taking a lulav of an esrog on Shabbos, and we make a shachianu again the second day if I did that because it's nothing. Or do we say, no, the mitzvah is still there, but the rabbis told us not to, and we mentioned this is probably related to the basic issue in Achronim between the Neshivas and the Joseph Engel and others, the question of do we assume that the rabbis can create an issue that will be inherent in the object? Or do we say, no, that's only true by Dinim Daraisa, but the rabbis can't do that, they only have authority over you, and therefore objects all remain the way they were, and so too the Torah remains the way it is and cannot be rewritten by the rabbis, as opposed to this Engel's opinion that a Kaddish Baruch Hu agrees on this specific change. And we mentioned that this would therefore affect certain cases where we have mitzvahs in the Torah that the rabbis told us to perform differently, such as Kiddush and Birkas HaMazon, where Kiddush said they may not require wine in the Torah, and benching doesn't require four brachas in the Torah, and yet the rabbis say we need wine and we need four brachas. So then the question becomes, if I do it without this, do I fulfill a mitzvah in the Torah? Or do we say, no, even that is no longer there? And we mentioned this appears to be an achlokus between Tosfos and the Ran in the beginning of Sukkah, discussing certain gezeiros that were put into place affecting the mitzvah of Sukkah, and the Ran says that no, it doesn't really mean that they're really changed, which will see Tosfos in his comment in the Haggadah, that whoever doesn't say these three things isn't fulfilling his mitzvah, that the Ran authorized is now literal, just talking about not fulfilling the mitzvah perfectly. And I mentioned this also related to the Yonah's comment that after Chatzos, Chacham said he can't read Kriya Shema at all, and this is a debated topic. And that all of this seems to come to this question of what happens when Chazal are open in the Torah, is it down or is it just put in, or is this for orders not to do it? And then we mentioned this also, then the second, leads us into the second question, the question of how do we define Seiv Al-Kais, does that mean passive behavior, or does it refer to categorization of the Seiv versus Los Seiv? And we mentioned that this was expressed by the Rashbah in a few places. The Ran and the Rashbah differed in their understanding of how Chazal could cancel out Shiva. That the Ran says you have to still behave passively because you can't put active violations, and Rashbah says no, the whole concept of Shiva was uprooted, so apparently the issue there again is passive or the categorization. And the second issue in the Rashbah was the statement in Rashbah that to do a mitzvah twice is not bal tosfos, because apparently to not do a mitzvah is not bal tigra from Chazal, and the question was why don't we say Chazal is also bal tigra, apparently not possible. And the third position, the Gemara, that seems to imply, according to Rashi's reading, that the rabbis could allow us to violate Lo Shidzol if we just didn't pay back the loan. So that would appear to be a passive violation, but it would be violating the law. And the Rashi redefines that Gemara to say it's not talking about that again with Sitaso. And then the third question that we discussed, this question of why do we have this distinction, is it because it's a question of limiting the power that they can only go so far but they can't go that far? Or is it a practical point of conflict management? So that those are the two possibilities of a fun and offer. And then he pointed out how all three really tie together, that if the mitzvah is completely pulled away, it's completely canceled, so then it might be relevant to distinguish based on how far of an uprooting we're doing, and therefore we would distinguish based on categorizing, because that's where we find severity, while if the issue is that they just told us not to do a mitzvah that remains in place, so then the issue would be that we're looking for passive so as to avoid active conflict, and then our definition of let's say versus also say would be based on behavior rather than categorization. Okay, so we'll stop there. If anybody has any suggestions as far as topics, as far as the way the one types are presented, as far as types of concepts in general, as far as anything like that, please let me know, and I just have a question before.
Mm-hmm. Which permits that one might be comfortable Number two is, if Purim is on Sunday and the Gila reading is on Shabbos night, why isn't there a Pashat that one may come to carry the Gila on Shabbos? So in other words, you're talking about the Rabban seemingly being triggered to the altar of Mitzvah Daraita for with the risk of being Maschabel, a bigger Avera Daraita, as opposed to being altar of Mitzvah Rabban for the same reason.
Right, so the issue of seemingly really seems to be the key phrase. It's very hard for us to evaluate that. This is an attitude that we find in Chazal throughout, in the quest of our ability to compare Gezeirah one to another, to know really what motivated the Gezeirah in this case, what prompted putting in an ethnic in that case, what level of risk motivated Chazal to act. It's very difficult for us to determine that. You know, the situation, for example, the cases that you mentioned. So is it risky to say that we'll let you light candles close to Shabbos because maybe you'll come light on Shabbos? Maybe so. Is it riskier than maybe Shabbos in general? Who knows? One could say probably not. Didn't we have all the time and people don't necessarily violate Shabbos because of that. So to say that Hanukkah candles create more of a risk is a judgment call, which we don't necessarily know that Chazal would have to agree with. To say that we're worried after, that if you're doing something after Shabbos to come to carry on Shabbos, is that a risk? Yes. Is it the same risk that you'll carry on Shabbos for something you're doing on Shabbos? So probably not. There definitely seems to be a gap there. So the question is, why didn't they go farther and include that? So we don't know. We don't know exactly how they made their decision. It has to do with some type of calculus as what are the likely pitfalls, what are the likely areas in which something to create a problem. And most of that's just what many of the shonen write, that we don't have the ability to be madame, and also we don't have the ability to compare one case with the Tosfos in the beginning of Palabasa like this. We don't have the ability to look at one dinder abundant and think we could figure out another dinder abundant, because there's so many different factors that Chazal incorporated into their decisions, and many of them are hidden from us, that we can only follow what we have. Hi.
When you say that when the petition was offered, that basically the Chacham contains reality, is there a concept that it contains back again? I guess the case I'm referring to is the famous case about 100 years ago in Yerushalayim, where they had the Rav who said, well, the temple will show for Yerushalayim on Shabbos.
In general, it was a question of the different types of gezeiros and are they able to be undone, and it has to do with a separate essay about this in the case. There are complicated rules depending sometimes whether the reason was included in the gezeira, which is something you don't even know, because you think we can know from reading the Gemara, but apparently you don't even know if you see it as a different kind of paper, that sometimes the Gemara told us the reason, but it doesn't mean that Chazal included the reason. But sometimes they include the reason, and therefore if that reason fails to be around anymore, so sometimes the gezeira goes away, and sometimes it doesn't. The rules of that are very complex. It doesn't necessarily, whatever those rules are, it doesn't necessarily have to affect this, because it could be, if we assume, like this Vengel said, that the way it works is that because Baruch agrees with what Chazal say, so then everything will just go with whatever the rules are. But if the rules are that the gezeira can be undone somehow, so then presumably Kirk Barthel would agree to that also. Or if the rules are that the Xavier was of a limited duration and expired, so then presumably the inherent Issa would also expire. So I don't think it would have to be affected by that question. I'm assuming that whatever the situation is, that there are rules that the Xavier can cease to exist under whatever circumstances. So you're right that it works better if we assume that the Din Torah was never changed to begin with. But even if we take the Rish Vengel formulation, that Kadosh Baruch Hu agrees, so reality is like that, so Kadosh Baruch Hu agrees following the rules. So if the rules are that the din doesn't apply anymore, then presumably that would be the case. Halach Shah is a function of stock, usually. And again, we assume that whatever the halach is for the rules conformed. And normally, halacha is a little bit of an abstract term. It basically means that somebody is issuing a fact that applies under these circumstances only and not redora. So if the question is, does that change Right. So the question is, how does that relate to what's going on behind the scenes? Yeah, we don't really know. But one could view that it could still fit into the same question. That again, similar to your previous point, that it works better if we assume that everything stays the same and we just are following the principle of Lost Russia. So it's not inconceivable to say the other way also. We don't really have a way to know. But I think both possibilities still would be conceivable. Okay, next week, should we okay.
Thank you, Roger. In regard to all best practices that we need to talk about, then in my scenario, so far, a little bit of a
problem, like I have to say, that's actually more complex one because carrying was always up. Right, the desire was that you shouldn't blow if you shouldn't come to carry. So carrying that's not even something that the rabbis put in. There happens to be a figure in the Gemara about that, which is why it's slightly different point, and it's related. But there is a different reason why you may not be chayav carry. So the Gemara has a discussion called tar b'davar mitzvah, that if somebody in the process of trying to do a mitzvah, somehow that leads him to do something wrong, so there is some mitigation there, but that's coming from a slightly different angle. But it's important to distinguish that carrying was never the issue was blowing shofar. But to give an example of that, there is a Sefer Eshkol in Siman Lamed Beis, quotes from Machlokes, let's say a person would wear tzadnus on his tzitzis. And so there, the Torah says to do that. And the Torah says to put tzitzis on, to put tzitzis on the garment, even if that means wearing tzadnus. And the rabbi said not. So let's say I do it, and I put tzadnus tzitzis on. So am I eligible for malchus for wearing tzadnus? That was the question that was asked. We say it's just no better than any other person wearing tzadnus, and just like they're wearing tzadnus, so I'm also wearing tzadnus. So Rabbi Chanan discussed the point. The Chaim Brisker had a different take on this. Rabbi Chanan explained it, that this seems to be the issue here. That do we say that there's no longer any mitzvah to wear tzitzis on the stomach? Because Chazal got rid of it. Now, yes, I'm no better than anybody else wearing tzitzis. That this guy wears tzitzis, he gets malchus, and this guy is also not doing anything mitigating. He's wearing tzitzis like everyone else. Or do we say no? There still is the principle in the Torah that the mitzvah of tzitzis, the Chazal told us not to do it, but at the end of the day, I'm not eligible for malchus because the Torah told me that I'm allowed to do this. The Torah told me I'm not have to do this. So therefore, there's not any malchus for that. So this example might work a little bit better with your class in a situation where somebody's wearing tzitzis against the din of Chazal, but in keeping with the din of the Torah, does one receive malchus for that? So that's this question that we... Sorry? So that way, assuming we're putting all the parts together correctly, that it would come out, the maybe the reverse angle would say, yeah, there's no longer any mitzvah of tzitzis, it's just tzadnus, and you're eligible for malchus. While maybe the nesivus would say, and again, no one's taking a flip of stands on this, we're tying it together parts, but maybe the nesivus would say that, well, okay, so the Torah told you to wear it, and the rabbi said not to, you're obligated to listen to the rabbi. But if you don't, so still you're meant to violate tzadnus because there's no tzadnus there. Next week, should we talk about something Purim related? Is that preferable? Is it going to make a difference? Alright, so something Purim related. Sure. Thank you very much.